Last time we were talking, you had just finished working at the UI for all during the war years. So tell me about what happened when the war ended. Do you remember that day in particular?
Yes, when the war ended, the interesting thing that happened was that about that time, a friend of mine in the union decided that he wanted my job. And we happened to have had elections. Until then, he was working with me, and I was really readily accepted by everybody, or they wouldn't have kept me for 4 years. I mean, generally, I felt I belonged. But he decided it was a good job, because by then, the pay had increased. You know, you were an official, and you didn't have to punch a card in the machine shops like we all did before then. Mm-hmm. And so an election took place, but a very sad thing happened. During that election, my father died, and I got word to come to Chicago for his burial. And I stayed a couple of weeks or something like that, and during that election campaign, he was conducting his own election campaign at, all kinds of flimsy slogans, and I wasn't there to in any way electioneer. So when I come back and the elections that take place, I don't even remember if we had an election. I think we must have. But I remember that the my own personal disaster in that situation was not only the death of my father, whom I loved very much, and had to go to the funeral, and the fact that it happened during that period. It was as if somebody was waiting to stab you in the back. It's true, you cannot reduce it all to a personal event. There was a union, there were officers and all that. Well, in any event, I didn't want to run for anything else. I think I got defeated in that election. And logic would dictate that I did a very good job, because I initiated that whole department, and we got good money, and we set up a collective of the Catholic Church representatives and the Jewish social service people and others. Strangely enough, I read only this week about a similar development in the NMU, the National Maritime Workers Union in New York, with Ms. Reynolds heading it up. Bertha Reynolds, the outstanding American social worker during those years and since. She's highly acclaimed as an important social worker. So these developments were taking place not only in my union, but in other unions likewise. And the trend was a good one, because I got all kinds of requests to go to Canada and other places to help set it up. But I believe that this man who was gunning for my job was an opportunist, an unprincipled man. Trying not to be vindictive in saying that he also left his wife and took up with one woman on our staff and created a great tragic development in his family life and so on and so on. So after that, I came to Chicago. That's my old bailiwick, where really I did my original basic political work. And I asked the party to give me an assignment. And I got an assignment, and I worked as an organizer for the Communist Party for quite some time, until about 49. I remember the last big thing I did is I led a huge delegation from Chicago to New York, to Judge Medina's court. Judge Medina was conducting the case of the national leadership of the Communist Party, who were supposed to have been the subversives in the United States. That was the beginning of the serious development of the McCarthy era, and all of them were convicted except William C. Foster, who, because of illness, was separated from the case. But I remember there were 100 or 200 people, I don't remember, traveling with me from Chicago for picketing purposes of the center where the court was located. I almost had the name of the court. testing my memory in the interim. And after about 5-6 days stay there, we came back to Chicago. The case was lost. The whole national leadership of the Communist Party began serving long sentences, some up to 8 years. I think a couple during that of that group did not show up for serving the sentences they hid.
Where did these subversive charges come from?
Well, that was under the famous, infamous Smith Act at that time. I think we could let that go for a while because Annie Burke would give you the details of that law.
But it was the Smith Act.
I'm pretty sure it was the Smith Act, that they, under the Smith Act, they were convicted.
Well, how come after the war has just ended, the United States is on top of the world, the Communist Party was super patriots, why turn on the communists all of a sudden?
Well, it's a good question, it's a deep question, because it wasn't all of a sudden. The developments against the progressive movement can be traced to a period before 1949, immediately following the war, because the Americans and the British weren't ready to make concessions to the victorious Red Army that was that had marched through Europe and really was the liberating army when the Soviet Union demanded the opening of a second front. It was ignored by the United States and by Great Britain, and it was really the tremendous sacrifice of the Red Army and their that was primarily responsible for the defeat of the fascists in Germany. History has since verified that, but at that time it wasn't too well known, but the administrations knew it, and anti-Soviet line began to shape up shortly after the war with the 1947 famous speech of Churchill in St. Louis, Missouri, speaking about the, I think he coined the term, the Iron Curtain at that time. And I may not be accurate in this, but the term, Truman had just taken over after the death of Roosevelt. He became the president. And Truman, I guess, had to convince the American wealthy class that he is no schmo, that he's going to represent them well. And so the trend away from the unity that prevailed during the war began to crack up. And there were different movements to isolate the Soviet Union and to grab what they could in Europe, as they did with the division of Germany and the setting up of the famous four-power deal around Berlin. Mm-hmm. And this was all reflected in the policy to isolate and separate, isolate the radical forces that who were growing up during the war. The trade union movement had developed to a very large extent. Women opened, the doors were open to women, and the industry opened up their doors to the women, and they flocked in to replace the 11 million men who were taken into the services during the years of war. And so the unions were replenished by these militant women and the militants who had come back from the war. And the feeling for the Soviet Union was very high. The admiration for the courage of the Soviet Union was very great. And so the American ruling circles had to find a way of breaking through it. And Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin was a very accommodating gentleman and began the red baiting and the denouncement of the Soviet Union as the enemy of the United States and the American Party as a foreign agent working for the Soviet Union. And so the terror began much sooner, but it culminated in the arrest of the whole national leadership and the famous trial of Judge Medina. And the entire left throughout the country was concentrating on protesting that development and holding it back, but we didn't succeed. So to go back to the personal angle, the question you asked, I stayed in Chicago about a year or so after that.
Did you live with your mother?
No. I could not return to my parents' home. I had outgrown that environment. I now needed a place for myself where I could have my books and journals and the freedom that I enjoyed as a single woman. And living with Orthodox parents like mine, who were adorable, and one brother who was 2 years older than I, still stayed home, but who was quite backward in his politics and otherwise, I had to continue living by myself, and I did, strangely enough, but I lived with people who were communists, who rented a room. I say strangely enough because 50 years later, their niece became my literary agent. It's just one of those.
So you rented a room in a house?
I rented a room of these comrades and stayed there. And I was only about 10 blocks away from my parents. I visited them very frequently.
How did your mother live now that her husband is dead?
My mother was supported by my younger brother. And the house had been paid out. And there was a tenant now living upstairs. It was a duplex. And my mother did not have serious financial problems because we all somehow donated money against her wishes. We somehow managed to get money into the house. My brother, who lived there, was the main financial support, but also she rented a room in the house, since I wasn't there, my other sister wasn't there, and the children were all there.
Do you think that was fairly common in Chicago and other big cities at this time for a family to get a little extra income by renting a room?
It may not, but I could not confirm that because I didn't watch that aspect of life, whether the people were renting. I could tell you what happened during the Depression years, but what happened in 49 on that score is very difficult for me to ascertain, really. I never was interested in that aspect of it. It may and may not.
So what happened when this trial concluded tragically?
Well, as I mentioned, I came back to Chicago. The leadership began to serve their term. A couple of men, Henry Winston and Gilbert Green, did not show up. They were in hiding. They didn't start serving their term. And the McCarthyite period began to unfold in all seriousness. There was then, shortly after the arrest of the second layer of leaders of the National Committee, not all were picked up in the first scoop. And what happened, to get a little closer to my own situation, is that I've had this sister living in California, and while the terror was prevalent all over the country, I felt that my usefulness in Chicago would probably be greatly diminished if I remained there. I wasn't integrated anymore. I had come back after the war, just stayed a few years, and I thought I could say that there was also the satisfaction in my personal life. I had yearned for establishing my own family in some way. And I knew I couldn't do it in Chicago because politically I was so roped into all the work that it was a matter of 24 hours identification completely with the movement. And I never verbalized it that way then. But looking back, I can say that a desire to go and join my sister and her family on the West Coast was probably prompted by a desire to see if I can rebuild my personal life on the West Coast more satisfactorily than it was either in New York or Chicago. Even though I was not a youngster anymore, but that desire has never diminished. People always want to get married and build their life, in those days anyway, because it was not only a token of stability and respectability.
How old were you now?
Well, in 1950, I was already 41 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
40, 41. We were always off 1 or 2 years because of the mix-up in our passports, you know. Having been an old maid by that time, and not acceptable to the family in Chicago, aunts and uncles and cousins and others, and the parents looking down upon their youngest daughter remaining unmarried, I felt a general discomfort in that respect and had secretly hoped that the West Coast would open for me the romantic roads towards marriage and so on, without having ever vocalized it or verbalized it. I don't remember what excuse I gave, but possibly that my sister needed me because her family was, the children, one was just born a year or so ago and another one was coming on its way. So, and because things were very disturbed all over the country with regard to the communist organization because of the attacks upon it, the party was not unfriendly to reshuffling and reshifting the personnel. And so I didn't have any difficulty to get my transfer to Los Angeles. And so I came to Los Angeles either at the end of 49 or the beginning of 50. It's a little vague in my memory. And I settled with my sister. And
this is in Los Angeles?
That was in Los Angeles in 1950. There was an extra room, and that problem was okay, but I'm trying to trace something else, something that happened later. No, that is so far as accurate. So here, my life was not so difficult because I was immediately assigned to go to work in the new shops that were unorganized. And I refused to go to work at a trade that I was better, more knowledgeable in, such as bookkeeping, short and typing, switchboard, all the skills in the office field I was fully familiar with because I did a little of that in the Communist Party offices too. And I used to take down speeches occasionally and transcribe them. But I wanted to become part of the industrial proletariat. And Los Angeles at that time had something like 60,000 black women and Chicana women who had flocked into the needle trades industry, the unorganized shops, which we called alley shops. And I was quite pleased to go in and see what I could do with regard to assisting the ILGW, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, in organizing these unorganized shops. So I became a member of the union, and I went out to work, and I rapidly developed a rapport with the alley shops where I worked. You don't stay long in any of the shops, because the employer kicks you out as quickly as he detects that you're trying to even talk to another person. But it gave me my skill in the industry. I became an operator in these shops, and the finisher and the sample maker, and learned the trade quite well, so that as I went from shop to shop, I became more eligible for organization because workers recognize skill as much as anything else in the organizing field. And I succeeded in building up a mailing list of 200 women, black and Chicano, with whom I became friendly during the period of maybe a year's operation of that kind, going in and out of shops, either under the excuse of wanting to visit them or to send them Christmas cards or Easter cards. I built up a good mailing list, and I began to send them Communist Party literature, and we were very sectarian in our methods of organization at that time, very sectarian. While I worked through the union in informing the union what I was doing, that I was in the shops, the union really didn't give a hang about me or what I was doing. they were much more concerned with the work among the skilled, the men, the women's suit makers, and I forgot what the cloak makers, and the dressmakers, and not the sports section of the industry. But nonetheless, they treated me with some respect. You know, when I came and reported that here is a shop of the 98 girls, and I already have 40 lined up, and all we have to do is give out a leaflet. I think we can organize them. So by the time we were ready to do it, I got fired. And it's doubtful whether the employer fired me on his own or whether through some other, for some other reason. I'm not ready to accuse anyone, but it was a little bit, I was a little bit suspicious why I got fired so readily after I reported my good work in the shops. Now, I don't mean to say I was the only one.
Mm-hmm.
We had a few others, but very few who went into that part of the industry. We had others who were working among the cloakmakers and dressmakers. We had a big party organization there. But in the sportswear, I was among the very few. We had a few of the cutters, but they were the higher paid. But the operator, the one who was right on the floor running a power machine, I concentrated on that. And of course, I felt that my revolutionary integrity was constantly being tested, and I was therefore feeling very heroic about what I was doing and very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it was highly satisfactory because I liked the work. There's quite a bit of creativity connected with making a garment that you know nothing about, and they throw a bundle at you and you try to put it together. I mean, you got to make 18 of them a day in order to clear your $4 at the end of the day, you know. And so it was a big challenge in that respect. And some of those women, including me, were making very little. I remember when my friends in the dressmakers industry division, I mean, those in the cloakmakers were coming home with $70, $80, $90 a week. I was still showing $18 and $20 and $22 in my stubs, you know, my checks. So it was, in a way, as though I were doing literally Communist Party work within the plant as an assigned communist. I couldn't see it in any other way, because we had communists working in the other shops who were making very comfortable livings. In fact, some of the very highly skilled were able to buy property later, and it was fairly comfortable. And I was still, I'm not looking for sympathy in that case, but since I was a full-time Communist Party organizer, this was very much in line with my whole makeup and my whole spirit of working for the movement. So it wasn't a matter of a great sacrifice, it was continuing in that spirit. And shortly after that, it might have been sometime in 51, the party had leadership had a meeting, and they invited me to come. The terror here in California had increased very much, and they advised me to go into hiding. And that began my four-year period of underground life, which, if I were to summarize it, I would say was the most traumatic experience of my entire life, and which left me physically and, I must say physically, so shaken up that to this day I have repercussions from it. That 4 years in jail would have been by far easier than to live in a country where nobody accepts an underground and nobody wants to know about an underground, and where you have to make your way in different cities and different parts of the country to survive economically and to just sit it out. And while the McCarthy era was developing to its very highest level. And so the experiences of that period, I've written up in one of my books. I really dread the idea of going over that again.
I'm just curious, does going underground mean you live in somebody's cellar for 4 years, or that you move place to place week after week?
No.
I mean, I don't have a clue as to just what you do when you go underground besides keeping a secret. I mean, do you change your name?
Oh, well, first of all, the decision was to leave Los Angeles and go to another city where I had never been to, as a means of getting lost with the crowd and go and get a job. Well, a city you've never been to, I don't know its geography, I don't know its people, but I'm given the name of one of my comrades, not within the city, but maybe on the outskirts of the city. If in great trouble, I should get in touch with that person, or to at least let that person know where I was so that they could keep in touch with me. So the link between the Communist Party and me, who was told to go and get lost, was not altogether broken. And that was a very important thing. Otherwise, you had to come out from the underground. So I go to a city where I had never been. And you get off the bus with a little suitcase, and you wonder, where do you go from there? So I have on me about $85, $90 saved up. Well, so you you get a newspaper, or you find out where the workers' community is, or I bought a map for 35 cents, I remember, and went into the ladies' toilet and began to study the map. And I had very little preparation on where to go and what to do when I get to that city. But I remember I found myself sharing a room, a woman advertised in the newspaper, roommate wanted. So I called and she says, no, it's not rented yet. And there I go and I park myself. And it turns out she's a waitress. But she is also a very high-class prostitute in the sense that she had several boyfriends who would occasionally visit her. And while she was a waitress, genuinely so, she wasn't satisfied with the income on that. She longed for furs and jewelry and a nice television and such things, which were very expensive.
You can't tell me what city this is?
No, indeed not. Because it's not fair to the Communist Party to reveal some of its connections and so on.
Well, I guess what I want to know, is this a large urban center, or is this in the middle of,
they are all fairly large cities, not the size of Los Angeles or Chicago, but large enough where you can go and look for work.
Okay.
Whereas in the countryside or in a small community, you become too conspicuous.
Right.
So naturally, I changed my appearance. I began to wear lipstick and make up my eyes and change my hairdo and generally began to make an attempt to not be recognized, which didn't help because my hair was still red and my accent was still with me as it will be forever. But a little bit of personal comfort you get from the idea that you think that nobody will know you because you've never been there.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I survived that particular city for quite some time. I think I lasted about 9 months there. I began to advertise in the local paper as an alterationist. And people began to come up because this woman with whom I shared had a sewing machine. And she herself gave me a tremendous amount of work to do her own alteration. And being quite creative with my hands in that particular field of work especially, I was able to remodel some of her old things. I had plenty of time. My house was, my home was assured I wasn't going to be evicted. She had a room to rent which was the size of my big clothes closet, the walk-in closet, but it had a window. And it had its private entrance. And that is why it was possible for her to carry on with her, at that moment, with her two boyfriends at different time. Her husband was overseas in Germany. And I began to do sewing there. And then I went out and did domestic work. That, I felt, was something anybody can do. And when they advertised, the woman wanted to clean up the house by the hour. It gave me a chance to go out early in the morning, 5, 6 in the morning when it was dark, and come back when it was dark, so that I wasn't seen too much by anybody. And so between doing a little alteration work for Josephine, I had looked her up about 10 years later, by the way, and some domestic work I did. I really don't feel too comfortable in going over that whole episode. Not that it's so painful, but it left me in a very bad physical condition, because after I built up an apartment that I had rented elsewhere and began to bring things in and began to start getting advertisements, put myself on mailing lists and all that, then I recognized somebody across the street. So I knew that they had traced me to this city or to another city. And I call it a four-year walk in one of my books. For 4 years I was walking from one city to another.
You would recognize somebody in
this city? Oh, yeah. I recognized somebody who was standing across the street and waiting for me to come out. What else would I need?
Was it a comrade, or was it some...
It was a guy who was later exposed as an FBI agent and was testifying for the government. I didn't know yet that he was doing all that.
Mm.
But once you recognize someone like that, you know you're finished in that community. So you go to another community. What do?
Mm-hmm.
You take your purse and all the underwear you can crowd into it, and stockings. And you have a big, I had a big shoulder strap purse. And you start walking as far away from the place as you can. Get a bus that goes anywhere out of town to some other big city somewhere, pick it up, not at the bus depot, but somewhere on the road, and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And from the map, you know where the next big city is. But there you leave with your contact broken, because my contact is in the city that I had just walked away from. So you work these problems out as you go along, and I built up maybe 15 or 16 different apartments and homes for myself, and had to leave my things there, you know, curtains and cooking utensils and an ironing board and a travel small iron.
Did you ever allow yourself to develop any friendships with anybody?
I did, only with a woman who hired me as her seamstress. She was a designer, and she needed a seamstress to do the finishing work, and I applied. And she hired me. And it was also a relatively good-sized city. I had never been there. I went to cities where I hadn't been to. And she liked my work so well that I really became her assistant. She let me do the fitting. She worked for the wealthiest families within the city. She was their designer. And gradually I became the finisher. The worker, I would make the fancy buttonholes, and I would do the very fine, after she faded the setting in at the zipper and rounding out the collar. I had good skill in my hands, and I wanted to use it, and knowing my life depended on it, I worked that skill up to a real professional level. And she could see that when I was ironing, she once told me, "Gee, your fingers are just beautiful the way you round out the bust line after you tuck in and you make a bust line. It can stick out if you don't know how to flatten it out and to round it out on the ironing board." All of these things, so that finally she even let me do some fitting. When she was sick, had a cold, and one of these rich bitches would come over, she would say, "Okay, you go down to the fitting room and take care of the blouse or skirt." So I did, and then she began to ask me would I consider going to a concert. She was married, and she was bored with her husband, terribly bored. He was about 20 years older. He was very retiring kind, and she was bubbling with energy even after a day's work, because she liked to work very much. She was very creative. She would go to schools to pick up new ideas on designing, even though she had been in the line already for a long time. And she did some beautiful costuming, beautiful work. I've seen them all, because I had to work on all of them. And it was in this play with her, I went to a couple of concerts, and I realized it was a mistake, because you're here, you are in the public eye, and how do you know who's looking for you? And sure enough, an FBI gentleman, I didn't know for sure, came. I was sitting right in front of that salon, she called it. They had to go by me before they would go to her. So, and he would come over and he would ask for a name that I had in some previous city. Are you Miss So-and-so? I said, oh, no, I'm certainly not Miss So-and-so. And I gave him my new name. In each city, I had a new name and a social security number. And then I know I'm finished because he already has me. He's just playing a game with me to see what I would do. Because for them, it was very important that I should lead them to the underground leadership. And so they left us in the field as much as they could. But I had to walk away from that situation right after that. Then years later, when I went and visited her, too, with Angela, she told me how the FBI was pestering her about me. How did she get me?
Did she ever know that you were, or did you confide that you were a communist?
Oh, no, no, no. You don't do that to anyone. Mm-hmm. You don't do that to anyone.
Now, I'm a little confused. I thought you said that you were and Angela married when you were 43. And that
he was 43. I was 45. But we waited for each other for those 4 years. We waited. We had met before.
Oh, you had?
Yeah, we met before.
He was in the party in Los Angeles?
He might have been. I don't know whether he was or not. He might have been. But I met him on the east side of Los Angeles in 49 or 50. A dance that was given for the benefit of the Chicana left radical forces on the east side. And from that dance we went in my neighborhood where I lived in the Echo Park area to a party that was held a couple of blocks, a block away from where I lived at my sister's. I had my own apartment at my sister's that I rented from her. And Angela went to the party, which was a block or so away, and I went there. He didn't have a car, and I didn't have a car, but somebody took us to the party. Since I found out the party was a close walking distance, at that time, you could walk home after a party at 1 or 2 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And that began, then we met a few more times. We went out after that. I remember I invited him to a New Year's party at my sister's. It must have been at the end of 50. I cannot trace that, but I know that for 4 years we haven't seen each other after having had about a half a dozen dates that he
Were you very, did you feel very serious or special about him when you had to go underground?
No. I could not say that I went underground leaving my boyfriend behind. Mm-hmm. But I went underground frequently thinking about him, wishing that I could have had Angelo as my boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And he thought about me all those years because he made inquiries from at my sister's all during the 4 years. My sister knew about my welfare because I had written letters and through the underground, it came 2 months late, but she got it, in which I described my health was good. I didn't in any way worry her with my problems. Mm-hmm. And I also indicated that my spirit was very good. My spirit was always very good, but I had seen dozens of my comets fall by the wayside. They, I would on occasion meet from time to time, and I would make inquiry, where is so-and-so? And I would be told so-and-so had to go out of the underground, couldn't make it. By making it means you can't sustain yourself. The Communist Party could not support several thousand people in the underground. They had to go and make their livelihood. And some of the people who went underground just didn't know how to do it. Couldn't work in their own professions for different reasons and couldn't shift like I was shifting from domestic to sewing. And then at one time I worked in an insurance company. I was the secretary to the top man in the insurance company, big city, a big job. I remember that very well because I made a suit for myself and my the thread I used was very bad and my back split and there I was standing filing something and my behind was showing. And he had to tell me, you have a run in your dress. And that's how I remember him. That's about all I remember.
So how did this end?
It ended by your 4 years of staying underground, doing all of this work, and the McCarthy era worked its way out. There was recognition by the middle, by 1954, 55, that he was a dangerous element in the United States. And he was being defeated in different ways. And he was the first senator who was censored by the Senate.
Oh, really?
Because he took on the army and some of the leaders in the army. And again, I'm not going to trace that development because you've got to be historically very accurate on that. And his stock fell considerably. And there was a revival of the open work of the left radical movement. And the underground, most of the people had come out from underground. I was among the very last ones that came out. I don't know why I was being penalized like that. But you couldn't come out unless you got permission, naturally. You don't act anarchistically. At one time, I felt that the underground was a mistake, as I do now, a total error in the work of the party. And after having been away for about a year and a half, I sent a note that I believe this is a total mistake, that I should get back to the shops and work among the people and let them defend me in case I'm arrested, so I will have a base. And I got back a note, take it or leave it, you stay there. Well, being an old disciplined Bolshevik, you don't leave it, you stayed.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed until I got permission to come out. And when I got permission, I came back to my sister's, to Los Angeles. And I had the apartment upstairs and so on. And shortly after that, I met Angela. Oh yeah, the New Year's party was after I came out. I came out in 55, and at the end of 55, we had a nice New Year's party at